Well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Soleri Report Dr. Catherine Albrecht. She's been with us twice. I really encourage you to go into the archives and listen to both interviews. She's an author, expert, co-author of arguably the best book on the whole topic of spy chips and invasive technology. She is a very sought-after radio host. I think she's the top speaker on the topic of the risks of technology for invading our privacy. Catherine holds a doctorate and a master's from Harvard and is just unbelievably articulate on this topic, and it's always a pleasure to have her on the Soleri Report. So, Catherine, welcome to the Soleri, and I wanted to also mention you're an executive with the search engine Start Page, which many Soleri Report subscribers now use thanks to you, and there's a new email program, Start Mail, that I want to talk about, too. So with that, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Hey, Catherine. It is so good to come back and give people an update. I've had a lot of exciting things happen in the last year, and a lot of things that I've been working on for many, many years come to fruition. And there's no time like the present, I suppose, because the things that we're up against seem to have become even more compelling, I think, more gruesome, more apparent to regular folks. So I think it's good that we have these conversations periodically and just keep everybody on top of things.
We just published our annual wrap-up, and one of the top stories that we described in trends was transhumanism, which, of course, gets into a lot of these. So I have questions about that as well, too. But let's go back and very quickly tell us how it is you came to write Spy Chips and really become the expert in this area.
Well, you know, it's kind of been a long journey. I've been doing this for 15 years now, since 1999. I guess it's coming up on 16 years here shortly. And really the genesis was all the way back to the time when I was a little girl. I was 8 years old, and my grandmother cautioned me that there would be a time when people wouldn't be able to buy or sell without a mark. And that, of course, is the infamous Mark of the Beast, as described in the Book of Revelation. And I promise you, this is the 1970s. We didn't have any of the surveillance equipment we have today. We didn't have high-speed, ubiquitously networked computers and for cash registers. We didn't have satellites up in the sky posting our every move on the internet. We didn't have an internet. We didn't have barcodes. There was really none of that. And in fact, I had never even seen a credit card. I knew they existed. I knew there was something called Diners Club, and some people had them, but I'd never seen one. And everybody I knew paid with cash or check. And so when my grandmother asked me to promise never to take a mark with a number to buy and sell, it seemed like a no-brainer that, of course, you won't do that. And I also remember, as at the age of 8, being really struck by that thought and asking myself, you know, are we ever going to come to that point? No, I don't think so, but I'll tell my grandkids and great-grandkids, and someday when this happens, they'll know not to take it. And in my 30s, I became aware that many of the things my grandmother had talked about, buying and selling with a number, she passed away the following year, by the way, so it was really a tragic thing that I lost her, but I'm glad she shared that with me before she went to her reward and went to be with Jesus, because I know that's where she's at now. But for decades, I just did my own thing, and I in fact, part of my resume or my bio there is that I took courses at the MIT Media Lab. And back in the early 90s, I was one of the first people to develop a web page, be using the internet. I was part of a whole bunch of groups that have since morphed into transhumanism at MIT, in the MIT Media Lab. And really on the wrong road, I guess, is the way to put it. I remember telling some of my professors, including Professor Sherry Turkle at MIT, who wrote The Second Self and has written a lot of questioning things about it, the internet, that I thought she was an old fogey. I was in my 20s, and I said, this internet, it's the wave of the future. You just got to get
it's wonderful, all these wonderful things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember.
And I remember her cautioning us, because at that point they had just begun the Human Genome Project, and her saying, you know, at some point they're going to map out the entire human genome and then just imagine what kind of powers they'll have. And I was like, ah, come on. So it's funny. I've gone from being a rah-rah technology pro-technology 20-something to being a very much Luddite, cautionary person at this point in my life. But that sort of all of that coming together in when I was, well, I guess 1999, I became increasingly concerned that the things my grandmother had warned me about when I was a kid were actually happening. We had the mobile speed pass where people were able to buy their seven, you know, their mini mart groceries and pay for their gas with the wave of a fob that was transmitting a unique ID number. We had people paying with credit cards left and right. And by that point, I think pretty much everybody who wanted a credit card had one. They used to be really hard to come by, but then they were giving them out like candy. And I think it was the digital angel implant, the RFID implant that people were already starting to say, ooh, sounds like the mark, sounds like it might be that. And I think all of that sort of coalesced for me in 1999. I actually had a pretty extraordinary experience, which I will tell you because I know that you're a Christian. I actually had a visit by the Holy Spirit in 1999, the kind of thing that pundits and people historically write about. And I
right.
had that same thing happen, like the blown across the room, totally illuminated for an entire week of my life, picked up out of my comfortable life as a newlywed new wife and graduate student at Harvard and doing all these things to all of a sudden, kablam, I was suddenly an activist. And prior to that, I really didn't have any television or radio experience. I didn't really have a mission per se. And I really felt that I got picked up and put on this path, this path of a mission. And I remember when I was trying to come up with a name, I mean, I knew during that week that I was meant to research, of all things, supermarket frequent shopper cards, which were the primary people don't realize this now. Even now, you say supermarket frequent shopper cards, they go, what? Because everybody has one. They're kind of pedestrian. Nobody thinks about them. But it was actually the technology that was introduced through the 90s and the early part of the next decade that made it so that there is now an RFID reader device at virtually every point of sale terminal, what we used to call a cash register, in the world. They now have these things to receive individual numbered identity from individual shoppers in Vietnam, in Thailand, in Yemen, in Jamaica, in Venezuela, in every country pretty much on the globe. And nobody really seems to have noticed when that infrastructure was put in place. But now you've got an infrastructure that has converted the cash registers into devices that can actually request and treat people differently based on a unique ID number associated with each individual shopper. And so I think that coming together was really where I got involved in my own activism. And in fact, I switched my doctoral research topic at Harvard to researching supermarket frequent shopper cards. That's what I wrote my dissertation on. I'm probably the world renowned first foremost expert on, of all things, supermarket frequent shopper cards. But That infrastructure, literally billions of dollars were invested in developing the ability to link individuals to their purchases at the point of sale at the world's cash registers, whether they're food, clothing, everyday dry goods, whatever it might be. Literally billions of dollars and about 10 years worth of effort went into making sure that all of those cash registers were equipped with this technology. And what's happened since, of course, when you bring in the RFID part of it, is that they've all been equipped not only now to take a frequent shopper card or an ID number, but they've also been equipped to take a radio frequency-based payment. And this is actually kind of interesting because when we wrote Spy Chips back in 2005, it's been almost 10 years now. I guess we need to come out with an anniversary version. But when we wrote Spy Chips back in 2005, the big concern was that they were going to put these RFID tags in consumer products. And for people who don't know what that is, this is a tiny microchip antenna combo that can be stuck on or molded into or woven into the things that we buy. And there were really disturbing plans, which we detailed in our book, for how to use those spy chipped items that people own in order to track and surveil them and to keep tabs on what they own, you know, be able to scan the contents of a woman's purse from across a room, that kind of thing. And the biggest, the two areas where we most said this would be a real problem is number one in tagging people and number two in tagging payment devices or payment cards. And those are the two places where we've seen the most traction with RFID, which is kind of ironic, right, because here we were warning that, they would tag products that could be used as a proxy for tagging people, and instead they just went right to the cut right to the chase. So as your listeners are listening to this and they're saying, oh, RFID sounds really terrible, I guarantee you that at least half and probably more of your listening audience, if they were to open up their wallets, would discover that they themselves have RFID tagged credit cards in their wallets. And these are the ones that are Wave and Pay. They have a little symbol on them that looks like sort of nested letter C's or letter D's. They're kind of the little emanating wave symbol. And that technology, the very same technology that in the 1990s and 2000s they were implanting into animals and into people and into people's hands and their arms, that exact same microchip technology is what's now been implanted into all of the credit cards. So what it means is that we've now got every grocery store, every major department store, every major shopping locale on planet Earth capable of receiving an RFID-based payment, which is right now being done through our credit cards. Of course, that would be an intermediate stage. First, you get the credit card that gets everybody paying with a number. Then you get the RFID that gets everybody paying with a number that can be transmitted through things, and then you put the number in people's hands. And
right,
we have this is what people don't understand. The technology, the infrastructure, was quietly put in place over the last 15 years to make it possible to take a payment device and instead of putting it in your credit card, put it directly into your flesh. And then you can press
right,
the flesh up to the reader device at the cash register and you can make your payment on the fly. The technology is here. So the things
right,
that my grandmother warned me about back in the 1970s were that seemed so distant.
You know, I'll never...
They're here.
I'll never forget going to the state fair, a state fair in Tennessee. And here I am out in rural Tennessee. It was a couple years ago. It was right after we had you first on the Salary Report. And there was this big booth with a group of people trying to talk low-income people into having their children's chips so that they, you know, could make sure they didn't lose them and track where they were.
Yep.
And you looked at it. Of course, we've seen it done with the pets as well. And you realized, oh, my God. You know, they're working their way in. You know, and of course we've seen it with soldiers and people in the military.
Fair, but, you know, the other thing, I'm going to be calling for a boycott of Disney later this year, and I personally am boycotting them now, and everybody listening can go ahead and join me, because Disney is training children, conditioning people to associate these RFID wristbands, an actual RFID tag that monitors your whereabouts that you use to buy and sell, and associating it with the happiest place on earth and my 10th birthday and my wonderful summer vacation at
right,
the Disney World theme park down in Orlando, Florida. They are issuing something called a magic band to the kids that go into the park, kids, parents, families. And the magic band is literally an RFID tag, the same one you would put into an implanted microchip, but it's in a wristband on your right wrist. And they use it for everything from opening their hotel room to getting on the tram to buying lunch and french fries and pretty much anything you want to purchase in the park. You don't use cash anymore. You use your magic band. And in fact, they even use it to get on the rides. And if you look online, you'll see it's really creepy. They've got this glowing orb thing. It's a brushed metal orb, and then inside of it, outlined in green neon, is Mickey Mouse's head. And when you bring your wristband over to the head, the glowing Mickey Mouse lights up and glows brighter and says, you've been read. So kids, you can see this online. They have these unboxing events, and they're so excited, and they're screaming, oh, hooray, my magic band. In fact, they've even got stores throughout the theme park where you can go in and just like you would buy a balloon or a commemorative mug, you can go in and buy your little wristband holder so you can slip your wristband into something even more exciting, and you could be a princess or it could be Buzz Lightyear or the Incredibles or whatever it might be. And, you know, it's huge. It's a huge deal for people going to Disney, but it's also really deeply concerning to me that here's the technology that we've been told for 2,000 years to look for, that Christians have been on the lookout for 2,000 years, and now that it's here, not one peep. Not one peep. You don't hear anybody complaining. You're not hearing it from the pulpits, from the churches, from the activists, from anybody. It's very bizarre, and I think we were sort of cautioned in the Bible that it would be like this. But here's
the thing here's
that everybody's been looking for, and now that it's here, no one wants to discuss.
Here's what part of the challenge is. You know, the long ago, if you sat down and studied Revelations, it was told that the police states would come and force this on you. One of the things I've been watching, because I get a tremendous number of magazines just to sort of track popular culture, is the amount of money that's been spent on wearable technology and making it fashionable is unbelievable. And of course, they talk about how hot it is, how fashionable, and then it doesn't sell. It's not selling that well in the instances I know of. But the push to make this fashionable and to have people want it is enormous.
Yeah, and I think you just hit on something totally, totally on target, Catherine, which is that we always thought all the way through, like our generation grew up knowing about the Mark of the Beast. There were movies made about it. There were even songs on the radio played about it. There were cheesy, campy TV shows made about it. And in all these scenarios, it was screaming bunches of people being hoarded into camps by jackbooted thugs that would shoot anybody who resisted. And in reality, that's not at all how it's being ushered in. We thought that it would be obvious and that people would have a choice of either resisting by, having their lives taken from them or complying at gunpoint. And in reality, you see people actually paying for these technologies today. And this is really kind of the theme of my own radio show that I've been talking about lately. Is the difference between 20th century and 21st century tyranny. You know, in the 20th century, it was really about guns and tanks and goons and thugs and do what I say or I'll kill you. And people who dissented or disagreed got rounded up and put in camps. But there was a downside to that for the oppressors, which is that you then create a population that hates you and is looking for any opportunity to overthrow or topple or assassinate you. Whereas today, the new version, which is made possible because of social media, and I'll explain why in a second, is really about instead of getting people to do what you want to do against their will is bending their will. So you don't bend their actions, you bend their will, and then their actions follow.
Right.
So you've got a population now, even today, what was today's headline news? The ISIS hacks into the CENTCOM Pentagon Twitter account. And isn't that terrible? And, this happens right at the very same, on that very same day that we get this announcement from the New York Police Department that they're issuing a red alert and the FBI is on board and they're issuing an alert to all the police departments across the entire country that ISIS is a threat, not because of this Twitter hack, but because of some other thing. And then we get the report that that Paris is basically under martial law right now with 10,000 troops in the streets. And on the very same day, we also get President Obama giving us a little pretaste, a little appetizer of his January 20th State of the Union address, in which he tells us that he's going to be really, really cracking down on cybersecurity. And so you put all this together and you go, wait a minute.
Right.
So what's happening is you're creating a desire on the part of the population to be controlled when it comes to the internet. You're creating a desire to have the government have more power and more control to save you from those scary, scary ISIS terrorists. And you can do this in terms of government policy where they convince us or convince the majority of the population that this is exactly what has to happen and they would, come at you with a pitchfork if you try to suggest otherwise. They also do this with consumer products because if you think about it, 20, 30 years ago, there's no possible way, back when we were watching those videos, for example, or those TV shows, if they would have said the government is going to issue a tracking device and know the exact location of every person in the country, we would have freaked out and fought them with guns and tanks, or we wouldn't have tanks, but pitchforks at least. And today, all they have to do is couch it in a nice, sleek exterior package, and they sell it to us as a cell phone, and they get us to pay $400, $500, $600 for the privilege.
Yeah, we're paying money for the privilege of
tracking device. Yeah.
So quite clever.
Instead, it is clever because it serves a couple of purposes. Number one, it makes them rich. Number two, it gets them, it gets us exactly where they want us, which is within their crosshairs, able to be observed and watched. And number three is it causes us, because we believe that they're our friends, it makes us into huge proponents of these things instead of opponents. So they don't have to watch their backs. They know that everybody loves them. If they're Google or Apple or whoever, they know that they're that the greatest thing since sliced bread, and everybody loves them. In fact, it's funny. The two most trusted companies in the United States among U.S. citizens last year were Google and Disney.
I'll never forget one of the most interesting conversations I had was with a very senior retired military guy who worked at the defense. There's a very large defense contractor with a major installation right next to Disney. And he regaled me with a 411 of how the defense contractor develops everything and then they give it to Disney and Disney gets all the credit and they're sick of Disney getting the credit, but they need to do it because, you know, they need to keep it all secret. So I didn't know if you realize a lot of what's coming out in Orlando is developed next door by the military.
I would love to talk to you further about that because I know that Disney is not a theme park. All right.
No.
It's an enclosed research city.
Right.
And there's few other places where you can actually have a population under your total control for 72 hours straight, where they're sleeping under your control, they're taking transportation under your control, they're eating and going to the bathroom and doing whatever they do 24 hours a day for 3 days in a row. And that's exactly what's happening at Disney.
Right.
And if people want to check this out, Disney actually has a research arm called DisneyResearch.com, and you can go online and you can look. They've trimmed it way back since 2 or 3 years ago when I first found it, and they've made it much more generic. But they have deep industry connections with the military, with Carnegie Mellon University. They're doing all kinds of research, and they boast that they have a captive audience on which they can test out these new technologies.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, if you want to see how to control the city of Seattle or the city of San Francisco, Los Angeles, or whatever it might be, your easiest bet would be to try it out first on Disney. And there you have people seeming
that's why
go places and do their own thing, and you can watch them.
When people say to me, you know, we're all going to be rounded up and put in camps, I said, don't be ridiculous. If we'll buy a cell phone that will entrain us, it's way too expensive to put people, you know, and you can't keep harvesting them. Instead, you have to feed them if they're in a... One of the things I try and explain, and I've always struggled with explaining the fact that if you can be tracked in this way, then your economic productivity, the value of it can be transferred to someone else and you're ground down to nothing. And this is very much sort of an insider trading system. And one of the best documentaries I've ever seen to help, you know, so for many people, it's hard to fathom how this works and it's going on and how this kind of intelligence flow can compromise your safety, your security, your economics. And Shadow Government was a documentary I know you made an enormous contribution to, and I think does a very good job of explaining to people how this works and what some of the risks are. And I thought maybe if you could just spend a minute or two on that, it would be great.
Yeah, I appreciate your bringing that up. That was actually the video for Grant Jeffrey, rest in peace. His final book was called Shadow Government. And Grant Jeffrey was a prophecy scholar and really great public speaker and really good disseminator of these kinds of ideas and concerns. And when the book came out, they actually contracted with Cloud 10 Pictures to create a video to go with it. And I was contacted actually as just a talking head to be in the video. But in the course of talking to the producers of the video, we realized that they were really struggling to try to figure out what to put on camera. And so, long story short, I stepped in as the associate producer of the film. I spent the next 6 months of my life flying around the country and interviewing people and really pulling out my Rolodex and saying, oh, you want to talk about this? Well, here's the people you need to talk to. So we've got everybody in there from Joan Vion, who was doing extraordinary work exposing the United Nations, and she, of course, passed from breast cancer. This was one of her last interviews. We have Li Tian from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have Chris Paget, who was the researcher who drove down the streets of I want to say San Francisco, with a car-mounted RFID reader and actually read people's real ID driver's licenses right through their purses and yeah. So we got footage of that. I mean, it's really an extraordinary film, I think, in many ways, because it really is sort of a snapshot in time of everything that I knew at that point in time, because I got all my friends to be in the video. And the thing I really like about it is it is the kind of movie that you can say to your friend who doesn't get it, who doesn't understand any of this, who thinks you're a conspiracy theorist, you can say, hey, listen, I know you think I'm nuts. I tell you what, just watch 5 minutes of this movie. And I guarantee you, if you put this film in, 5 minutes is going to turn into 10 minutes, is going to turn into watching the whole thing. There's no way that you can watch just 5 minutes of this movie. And there's nobody who's going to say to you, no, I don't have 5 minutes. I mean, people are willing to give you that much time, and then you've got them. So invite right. your friends over and say, hey, just 5 minutes, and then we can play Scrabble or whatever it is you're going to do. And instead, you'll wind up watching the whole film. And by the end of the film, and this is sort of the, I guess, the crux of all of this for me. By the end of the film, Grant Jeffrey, after we lay out this whole case of how you can be surveilled, and it's basically on the basis of it tells the story of a man. We sort of used him as the storyline, but he gets in trouble with the government because he's posting anti-abortion flyers, and they figure out who he is, and they trace him back, and they call him in for questioning, and it's sort of how all these aspects of his life lead them to figure out who he is. And by the way, he's doing nothing illegal. He's right. in no way doing anything in violation of any laws or anything else. It's just the world we live in today, where everybody seems to be under suspicion. And then at the very, very end, you have Grant Jeffrey step onto the camera, and he's holding a Bible in his hand. And that's the one thing I would say, if people are not Christian, you can watch the entire film, you won't have any Christianity at all. And when you see Grant Jeffrey come on, just you can turn it off. But if you are Christian, I think
it's really fine to stick. Yeah.
Says, you know, this is the end. This is the end game. This is the big picture.
Right.
This is what has been talked about for 2,000 years in this book.
One of my favorite times, I always think of you whenever these things happen. One of my favorite times this year was reading a story in Wired magazine about quoting all sorts of folks at Google who had no idea that the NSA had a pipeline right into the dark fiber. And they're going, oh, we had no idea. Thinking, well, what about now that you know?
I'm telling you. And you know, Google is really an interesting case in point, because Google, well, first of all, the Google founders, when asked what they want to become by MIT Tech Review, said the mind of God. And you know, the mind of God, that's a pretty massive ambition there. They are working to become exactly that. They want your DNA, they want the picture of the front of your house, a satellite picture of the your backyard, knowledge of every book you read, they want your calendar, they want your GPS location, they want to be the Android system on your phone, they want, it just goes on and on. And their recent acquisitions, I think this last year, say a lot about the company, because they've acquired military robots capable of hunting down people in packs and killing them in the woods. From Boston Dynamics, that's where you get Big Dog and these other really disturbing military.
And lots of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so they've got deep AI, they've got these really creepy military robots that you don't see any possible reason why a search engine would have And then they've also bought Nest, and I've been saying on my radio show for the last 5 years that Google is looking for a way to get into your home, and
right.
you've got to say no. And, of course, they bought $3.2 billion. They buy this company called Nest that makes, of all unsexy things, thermostats and smoke alarms. But if you think about it, what is there that is in all of our homes? We all are required by law to have smoke alarms. And so
right.
if they can
get And Nest makes beautiful ones.
Into the tent, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really about how can they get into our homes. And then, of course, they spent $500 million, which sounds like nothing compared to $3.2 billion, but it's a lot of money, $500 million buying Dropcam.
Right.
And you can go on YouTube and you can see these terrifying videos. I mean, really, I have to say the creepiest thing I've seen probably in the last 6 months is drop cam videos posted online where people are literally aiming these cameras at their beds. They're aiming them at their dining tables, and it's a camera and a microphone that is pumping constant surveillance video of you in your home up to the Google Cloud. And you just think, how could people be so stupid? Like, don't they, like, does any common sense enter into this? And this gets us right back to what we were talking about. It's not guns and tanks. It's not terror and fear. It's, hey, pay us $30 a month and we'll archive all of your dinner conversations for you. Yeah. Like, hello.
Well, the amazing, I don't know if you've ever, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I think Google is the company to watch. I think they're working to be the global brain, the mind of God, and I think that ultimately, you know, where there's a web, there's a spider. Where there's a net, there's a predator. And I think that Google's probably sitting right in the middle of that web.
Well, I have to tell you, I think your description is kind. I think, you know, I couldn't agree more, but I'm even more extreme when it comes to describing them. So talk a little bit about your search engine.
Let me just say something about Gmail, because this is the one thing that I would hate people to come away from this conversation and not know, and most people don't know it, is back in 2004, Google introduced Gmail. So they've gotten away with this for 10 years. Their goal at that time, they realized how much information they could glean about people from their search engine, because people type everything from divorce attorneys to drug abuse counseling to cancer treatments. They type it all into Google, and so Google got access to market research data beyond their wildest dreams. And if you want to understand what Google is, they're not a search engine, they're not an email company, they're a market research company, and the most profitable one in the entire history of humanity. They're so profitable that they're looking at building entire cities and airports, and I mean, they've just got money beyond just money to burn. And you ask yourself, well, I never paid for anything. When's the last time you ever paid for anything from Google? And then how is it that they're making literally just tens of billions, maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars?
Their intelligence operation. Yeah, their intelligence operation.
Yeah, they're an intelligence gathering company. And so back in 2004, their frustration was that they could not see the actual conversation. I mean, they want to know everything. They want to be the mind of God. They could not actually eavesdrop on our conversations. They had no way to get inside of our heads, inside of our homes, inside of our phones, inside of our email, inside of our communications with one another. So they hit on the bright idea of creating an email product so that they would be able to get on the inside of our email communications. And that's where Gmail came from. That's how we have Gmail. That's why Gmail exists, because this company said, I want to be able to know what people say to one another privately in their email. I can't hack into all the email accounts in the world, so I'll just create the world's biggest email program, and then I will give myself, perfectly legally in the terms of service, the ability to listen to, watch, record, read, analyze every single thing that passes through my servers in the form of email. And so they've given themselves an inside view of the most private aspects of our lives. And this is, I think when people realize this, once you realize this, you'll receive email from people at Gmail accounts and go, oh, don't they know? It really becomes a real visceral response that I don't even like corresponding to people at Gmail accounts, because I know that everything I write is being read as well. So that is why for the last 3 years I have been working on an alternative called StartMail. It's at startmail.com. And StartMail is a private email program that does not exist so that we can read your email. It exists because we're a privacy company. We charge $5 a month for it, so it's not free, because there is no such thing. I mean, somebody's got to pay the bill somewhere, and if it's not you, it's going to be a marketer or a government.
Right.
So we charge $5 a month. We have a special running right now where if you buy one StartMail account, you'll get two free companion accounts to give to your friends so you can immediately start writing private email. And I think probably the biggest contribution in StartMail is that we've taken PGP encryption, which has always been really hard to use, and we've got it down to one click, that a six-year-old.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
That, Catherine, that is such a huge.
encrypt this email box and you send your email and voila, it's automatically encrypted. If the person you're writing to doesn't have encryption, we have another form of encryption, which is question response encryption, where you just share the password in advance with the person and they type it in and then they don't view it through their Gmail or their Yahoo account. They actually go on to our servers in the Netherlands and view it in a private space there and they can reply to it. You can have a back and forth going on for 6 months that way.
So wonderful.
Really, I'm super excited about it because it's one thing to tell people this is terrible. It's another thing to offer them an alternative.
Right.
So that this is why for 3 years this is all we've been working on is getting StartMail ready. So if you go to StartMail.com, you can watch the 2.5-minute video overview. You'll hear my voice on there, and we're like I said, we've got this special running too. So we're pretty excited about it.
Well, I want to turn now to your book, and I'm so interested that you did this because as, you know, as I've been watching the wearables, as I've been watching all the sort of things rolling out, rolling towards the Mark of the Beast, I've thought, how in the world are we going to explain this to the kids? How do you warn the kids? And how do you warn the kids? And so you have now published a new book. It's for children. It's called I Won't Take the Mark of the Beast. It's the subtitle is a Bible book and contract for children. Now, this is clearly targeted at kids who have a Christian background and live in a Christian household. So I should say that before we start. But as we go through it, I'm going to talk about, okay, what are the Christian, what do the households do that are not Christians and whose kids don't have the Bible basis that you need, I think, to understand. But anyway, so how did it come that someone with all your expertise and professional clout wrote a book for kids?
I tell ya. Well, you know, it all comes back to those two pivotal events. My own grandmother telling me about the Mark of the Beast when I was 8 as sort of her last official opportunity to really have a huge impact on my life before she passed on. And then my own experience in 1999, which is the visit from the Holy Spirit, really. I had made this decision at age 8 that I was going to pass this information along to my kids and grandkids, and then in 1999 I got the very clear message that it is coming and it's coming now, and that my task in all of this was to write a contract for kids to inoculate kids so the kids could promise before this mark actually arrived, they could promise not to take it just as I had promised my grandmother. And really the book is all about the contract. The book is kind of the accompaniment to explain the contract, but the contract is really the meat of this entire project. And the contract is a beautiful frameable 8x10 certificate, which is in cardstock, and it's got beautiful illustrations of Bible pictures all around it. And it says, I love God and I promise to obey him. I will never worship anyone but God and I will never take the mark of the beast. I will call on Jesus Christ to save me and help me keep my promise. And there's a place for the child to sign their name, whether they're 3, 5, 10, doesn't matter. And then witness by, that's a place for you to witness. And then there's a place for the date. And on my website at virtuepress.com, I've actually got hand-selected frames that go with this certificate, matching frames, along with even a hook. We even provide a hook and a nail, so it's really easy. you can order this for a grandchild, for a child, for a niece, a nephew, a godchild, a special child in your life. And you can order all of it, the book, the frame, and the certificate. And the idea is that the book explains what Revelation, it really explains the Mark of the Beast portion of Revelation, that there will be a beast, he will rise up, he will confuse people and get them to worship him. And while a lot of people say, well, that's a terrible topic for children, it's really a good story because Jesus returns and fights against the beast and wins, and the beast gets thrown into a pit and locked up for 1,000 years. And it's a beautiful story of, you know, the marriage supper of the Lamb, the people living and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. It's got a beautiful ending. And so I have had non-Christian parents primarily say, well, that's a terrible thing to talk to kids about. And I said, well, hang on a second. We talked to them about Hansel and Gretel, about, you know, with wanting to fatten them up and eat them and shove them into an oven. We talk about Snow White, in which her very own stepmother wants to poison her with an apple and kill her because of her looks. I mean, this is crazy. So we have all sorts of stories that we tell children that have a conflict in the middle. They have a villain, a bad guy, there's a conflict, and then there's a resolution and a happy ending. And I think that all of those are sort of pale shadows of the true story, the real story, the ultimate story of the victory of Jesus Christ on this planet. And Revelation, far from being a frightening book, is really a book of God's love. It's a book about how he redeems this fallen world and restores everything to perfect wholeness. So it does have a villain in the middle, just like every other children's book I know of, and it has a totally happy ending. So my goal really was to facilitate this conversation for grandparents. We talk to our kids and parents. We talk to our kids about don't talk to strangers, don't do drugs, but something with lifetime implications or eternal implications of don't take the mark of the beast, we don't know how to have that conversation. So this is a book that facilitates that conversation. You sit down, 10 minutes, you read the book, you sign the certificate, and you've now made a lasting impression on a child. They will know,
right,
no matter, even when you're long gone, like my grandmother, that child will know someday if somebody comes at them with a mark that they want to put in their right hand to get them to, you know, participate in some horrible system, they'll know to say no.
Right. And they'll know that there's a force supporting them and saying no.
Yes. You know, that's the key. And in fact, the very, I know you have a copy of the book there, the very back inside cover of the book, we actually posted the sinner's prayer. Dear God, I know that I'm a sinner and you sent your son Jesus to save me. And I was actually saved. A few people know this, but at the age of 8 from a Gideon's Bible, from the sinner's prayer in a Gideon's Bible.
Isn't Gideon wonderful?
It was just amazing. I had the little tiny green leatherette. It wasn't a fake leather Bible. The little tiny green one. And I don't even know where I found it or how I got it. I don't remember Gideon's specifically handing it to me, but I was alone. And I was 9 years old, 8 or 9. It was after my grandmother told me about the mark of the beast. And I just remember this strong feeling of love and a strong feeling of just wanting to dedicate my life and my heart to this force of love, Jesus Christ. And so I, on my knees, all alone in my little house in California, I prayed the sinner's prayer. And so I wanted to include it in the back of this book for children who may not be in Christian households, who may come across this book, who knows, in a library, in a thrift store. I don't know where they might find the book, but I want them to have the ability to say, wait a minute, something in here really rings true to me, and I want to have a permanent connection. So that's in there as well.
Well, have you gotten feedback yet from parents who are using this?
Really positive feedback, yeah. It's overwhelming, actually. I've had grandparents and parents. In fact, a grandparent recently wrote me that she went through the book with her grandson through Skype, who is on the other side of the country, and he actually aimed the Skype at the book, and they read it together. And he was like,
uh-huh,
pictures are so beautiful. You know, whoa was one of his keywords. I think he's 8 years old. And he said, you know, whoever wrote this book and did these pictures did real good, Grandma. And he had no idea. That's the thing. Our generation grew up knowing this. You would be stunned, Catherine. You can talk to anybody from their teens to their 20s, and you can ask them, even if they go to Bible school or Sunday school every Sunday, go to vacation Bible school every summer, you can ask them, what do you think about the mark of the beast? And they'll say, the huh, the what of the huh? I mean, they it's amazing to me that nobody knows about this anymore. It's shocking. We've entered into a sort of a bizarre phase where this is the first generation in the history of Christendom who does not know what the mark of the beast is. And isn't it ironic, of course not, that it's no coincidence that this is happening when the actual technology to implement the mark of the beast is finally here. We are the first generation to have the ability to implement a mark to buy and sell with a number. Nobody's talking about it.
I don't understand is because I see so many Christians who do know about the mark of the beast, but they are relating to the technology without realizing it's being, you know, that they're being acclimated to it and that it's dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and what does the Bible tell us? It says that these things will be so deceitful that they would deceive even the elect if that were possible. So that means even Christians, if there's one thing we need to be praying for right now as a Christian church, as the body of Christ, it's for discernment. Please, Lord, right. help us see. Give us discernment. Give us eyes to see, ears to hear. Help us to see when these things are really just hissing serpent-laden, twining around us, trying to pull us down. And so many people have this relationship with the technology where they're addicted to it. They're staring at it all day long. They're ignoring their kids. They're ignoring their spouses. I was just at a gymnastics meet, actually, a couple of days ago, and I was stunned. There were 3 and 4-year-old kids just the whole time standing in the line, sitting in the seats. They were just glued to their computers. And then I looked at their parents who are doing the same thing. So we really need, I think, as a Christian community to take very seriously what the Bible says in Revelation about Babylon. Come out of her, my people, lest you be partakers of her sins and receivers of her plagues. We are meant to be a people set apart. We are not meant to be a part of all of that. And I know people say, well, you know, everybody's doing it. Well, everybody is going to take the mark of the beast pretty soon, too.
No, everybody's not doing it because the Amish and the Mennonites are not doing it. They know.
I think they knew from the very beginning that these things would come through technology. There's no question that's where these things are coming, that they will come through technology. Whether it's going to be the RFID implant is going to be the actual mark, we can't really say. I know some people who said, that's nothing, because people used to think, aha, it was the Social Security number, and of course it wasn't, and then they used to think it was the barcode, and it wasn't, so you're out to lunch too. And what I think is, had I been alive back when our grandparents were protesting the Social Security number, I would have been right alongside joining them, and I would have been right. Had I been active in the 1980s when the barcodes were being introduced, I would have been opposing that too, because it's all part of the same continuum. You know, if you don't want to get to New York, you don't hop on a train in Los Angeles and watch every stop bringing you a little closer, a little closer, a little closer.
Right.
Eventually, you just get off the train. And each one of those things was just a move closer and a move closer. And that's what RFID is going to be. That's what these implants are. And for all I know, they are the mark of the beast. I don't know. But I do know that there's a worship component, and we haven't seen that yet. But I think it's coming.
There's one thing I wanted to...
Let me give out, I just want to give out the book. It's available on Amazon, although that's not my favorite place to have people purchase it, because they've way undercut my price and I can't do anything about it. But that's Amazon.com, and it's also available at my website at virtuepress.com. The book is called I Won't Take the Mark, a Bible book and contract for children. And it's got my name, Catherine Albrecht, and also two of my dearest friends who've also played a role in this. So if you go to the virtuepress.com website, you can actually flip through the book. It's got, we did this kind of cool flip book thing where you can click on the book and you can click through the pages one by one, and you can actually see the beautiful artwork and how nicely put together this book was.
It's very lovely.
It's meant to be a keepsake. It's meant to be a gift book. It's, whenever we have choices of going the cheap route or the expensive route, I always pick the expensive route. We everything is high quality. We have the thicker paper instead of the thinner paper, and just every aspect of this book was subject to this idea in my head that this was going to be a gift book that kids would hang on to for life, and especially the certificate, because that's the key thing. The child signs it, and it winds up under a stack of papers. They may never see it again. That's not what the plan was. The plan is for the child to sign it and for it to immediately be framed in an 8x10 frame or an 11x14 frame and hung on their wall. And that way the child, every morning when they get up for school, every night when they say their prayers and go to bed, 1,001 times they're going to see that on their wall, and they're going to remember that promise. Whereas if you just read it to them once and they throw away the certificate or you lose it, it's not going to have that same impact. So the real goal was the certificate to be framed and hung on the wall so that the child is inoculated for life against the mark.
One of the things one of my churches used to have a wonderful, very graphical, very beautiful poster of the Ten Commandments, and it was placed where you could not miss it.
Yes.
So every time I went to the ladies' room, I had to read again the Ten Commandments. Yes. It was very effective.
It is. Especially, I think, for kids, because I remember everything in my room when I was a kid. I mean, I remember what was on the walls. I remember what the curtains were like. I remember all these aspects of my room because I was there over and over and over and over. And, you know, when you're a kid, a year is like 10 years when you're an adult. So
Right.
It was kind of like a lifetime that I spent being a kid and looking at the things on my wall. And in fact, my grandparents in the spare room that I used to stay in had a Madonna. We weren't Catholic, but somehow somebody had given it to them, and it was very beautiful. She was in a case, and she was totally gorgeous. And I remember telling my mom, I was like 5 years old, that I was going to grow up and that's what I was going to be. And she said, "Well, you can't be. You know, I was going to be a nun." She said, "You can't be a nun. We're not Catholic." The impact of this beautiful thing on the wall and me understanding that this was whether it was a nun or the Virgin Mary, I don't even know, but the concept of dedicating your entire life to serving God was just such an appealing idea to me at age 5. And again, that's just because something was on the wall in the room I was in. So it's really powerful, and people hang all sorts of ugly art. I hate to say it, but that sticks with your kids just as much as the beautiful stuff. So keep it nice.
There are a couple things I wanted to bring up in association with the technology you're talking about. One is, have you seen the documentary Terms and Conditions?
No, I haven't.
Okay, this is one you want to watch because it dovetails with everything you're talking about. A group of guys got together and did a real study of all the terms and conditions we sign when we use software or search engines or anything else.
Yes.
And it's phenomenal. It's very entertaining, and it fully disclosed. One of the things it says, if you and I read carefully every terms and condition that we approved in the process of using the average amount of software that people use, we would spend 3 months a year reading terms and conditions.
Oh my God.
I know. It's remarkable. And so the other thing I wanted to bring up, we have one of my favorite Solaria reports is I was running into problems with clients, investment advisory clients being targeted with entrainment technology. And it really scared me because if you can entrain someone to do something fantastically stupid with their money, you can obviously make a lot of money, but they can lose a lot of money. And they were having trouble understanding what I was saying, that this stuff really existed. And I got Adam Trombley to do a Solaria report on entrainment technology, including its application to financial fraud. And when you combine the terms and conditions that give incredible legal powers, you know, Facebook saying, okay, you know, we have right to access the camera and everything else in your phone and use it in whatever way we want. So when you combine the terms and conditions with the RFID technology and the entrainment, then you're talking about getting really frightening combinations. And again, you know, for financial fraud, the potential is terrible. I wanted to bring up something else, which I've never quite known what to make of it. I had a fellow who was fairly high in the CIA and then had retired try and persuade me that the nanoparticles that were in chemtrails, you know, the sort of little metallic pieces, I don't know if you've ever gotten into the subject, were one of the reasons they were present was they would coagulate in your body and create the equivalent of an organic barcode. And that was his...
Isn't that disturbing?
Yeah. So, I didn't trust a word he said. So I don't know what to make of it. And I always wondered if those big screeners at the airports were to, you know, to provide a feedback loop to see if they could get the system working. But one of the things that always concerned me was that we were being chipped organically through the spraying. Now, I don't know what to make of it, but if you combine it with terms and conditions, RFID chips, and the entrainment, you know, it just, the whole transhumanism movement is, you know, I hate to say it, it's a terribly gruesome topic to get into, but it's one I think we have to deal with, because the question is, how do I make sure my data is mine, and how do I make sure my mind and my body is mine, and they're all related?
Yeah, I think ultimately it's going to have to be a voluntary thing, because
right.
there's a tremendous amount of involuntary control that's happening. Even as I was discussing this whole ISIS Twitter thing is just a bunch of manipulation to try to get people to demand the things that they should be resisting. So there's a lot of involuntary, but I think when it comes to the actual control of your physical body, that's going to be a voluntary thing too. I don't think that's going to be snuck into us. I think it's going to be that people will be fully deceived and they will welcome this opportunity. And when you couple this with transhumanism, because I know you were talking about that earlier, I believe, this is just my personal belief, that the transhumanists who are offering us really the satanic version of God, they're offering us a fake version of immortality, they're offering us a fake version, or offering the planet a fake version of omniscience, a fake version of all of these powers of God to create and destroy life, to GMO, create, you know, new species, and all of these things are counterfeits of the powers of God. And I think that ultimately people will be offered the opportunity to remove their souls from their body, to literally upload their consciousness, their souls, into the mainframe, into the matrix for safekeeping, and that will offer them a form of immortality. And when you read the Bible, it talks about that people will be required to take this mark on their right hand and to worship the beast, that they go hand in hand. They're the same thing. But I believe there's a second, some other component to it, that somehow you're deriving something from this that is an indication that you don't trust God to do this for you. And, you know, there's few things that you can't be forgiven for in the Bible, and one of them appears to be, at least according to my read, taking the mark of the beast. I mean, once you've done that, there's not much left of you for God to redeem. There's really nothing there. And I almost wonder if that's not going to be some kind of giving yourself over to the system for quote safekeeping, and you're going to wind up in hell. I mean, that's
right.
That if you give yourself to Satan, if you voluntarily offer yourself and your soul to Satan for his version of immortality, you will wind up in hell. I mean, it's not that God's going to punish you in hell. It's that you're going to wind up in hell because of your own choices.
Right. And I would say you're going to get to hell before you get to hell. Right. That is hell.
That is
one of the things.
I mean, I've wondered if that's not literally hell. I mean,
yes, it is. It's slavery. So each one of us has to decide, are we born free or are we born a slave? And, you know, we each have to choose.
Ultimately free, because I'm a slave to Jesus Christ. I mean, I absolutely signed up in full servitude. But it's whether what does the old song say? You're going to have to serve somebody. It may be the devil.
Right. I love that song.
Serve somebody. Yeah. And the reality is we think we're free, but we will serve Satan if we're not actively serving God and not even know that that's what we're doing, but that's what will happen.
One of the things I really enjoy about this book is, first it's ritual, because I think ritual is very important and group agreement is very important. But I also think there's a real, when you create an intention, you're deciding to be on one side or the other. And when you create an intention and a commitment to be on the side of the divine, then the divine is for you and starts working for you. So it's a very, you're creating a power and you're calling on the power of the divine to come in and protect you. So, my experience is there's nothing like having Jesus on your side in a fight.
there's nothing to prevail against that power.
Right.
And this is really, I think it's difficult for adults to know how to have this conversation with their kids. I've talked to so many parents and grandparents who've said, thank you for writing this book, because it's something I wanted to talk about. But I mean, what do? You're coming home from a baseball game. Hey, sit down. I want to tell you about the mark of the beast. I mean, it's like, what? Random out of the blue, and yet with this book you can say, hey, I have this brand new book and I want to show you the book, and it's the most natural thing in the world to sit down and read these beautiful illustrations, these beautiful watercolor paintings, and to go through the pages of the book. Kids are fascinated, they're riveted by this book, and there's, you can just even leave it out sitting on the coffee table and the kids will gravitate to it and start reading it. You'd be stunned. And, I should mention, too, the book is not just for children, because each of the pages has a box on the left-hand side, a narrow, tall box, in which we actually put the original King James Scripture. So the format of the book is
okay.
The King James Scripture. On the left, you've got a big sort of parchment in which we translate that. I translate that into regular language for children, and then a beautiful picture on the right-hand side. So it's appropriate for small children. It's also appropriate for even high school age kids, because they can use it as a study guide and actually focus in on the scripture. It's even appropriate for adults. I can say most of the adults who've read the book probably did not know what was in the book of Revelation. So it's a great way to kind of familiarize yourself with what's in the book of Revelation as well. And we do that with King James scripture, because I think that's, it's critical that people be able to realize that every single thing in this book comes directly from scripture. We didn't make anything up. We didn't add anything. We didn't subtract anything.
Right.
It is exactly what's there.
What do you say to parents who are not Christian? What do you say to them? Because I think you really need a Christian grounding to understand the book and the presentation.
Well, I think that even if you don't have the grounding, and you read the book, because I've had Christian parents, non-Christian parents, non-Christian high school students, non-Christian kids read the book and say, this is a bunch of hokum, this is bunk. I mean, non-Christians. And yet, I always feel encouraged, because I know that the seed has been planted, that
the
message has been planted, and someday in the future, I mean, how many times have we ourselves said, oh, that's bunk? And then later we go, oh, it's happening right in front of me. Well, maybe I ought to go back and check that out. I mean, you and I as radio hosts find that all the time, where we look at something and say, oh, that doesn't sound right to me. And then later we see evidence of it, and we know where to go back to the source to find the more information about something that our own experience proves is true. And so whenever somebody reads this book and says, oh, that's a bunch of hogwash or whatever, I think that's fine. You're welcome to say that, because we don't see the mark here right today. But there is going to come a time when you're going to have the option of putting something in or on your hand, and you're going to remember this. And hopefully at that time, when you see this coming true around you, you will wake up and say, wasn't that, that's in the Bible. See, back in the 70s, back in the 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, everybody grew up knowing about it at least, and whether you believed it or not, you at least knew about it. And that's really where I want to get society back to, is where everybody knows about it. They may scoff, they may laugh, they may disregard, but at least they don't write things like these recent articles in Wired Magazine and elsewhere, where they don't even make mention of Christian opposition or the mark of the beast. There was actually an article in Wired where they were promoting an actual mark. It was kind of like a cross between a snowflake and a pentagram that you would actually put on your hand. And when you shook hands with a friend, like, it would light up and glow. And they're talking about a literal physical mark on your hand, and not one single mention in the article of, oh, those Christian nutcases are going to oppose this. There was nothing. And I thought, I would at least rather have them say the Christian nutcases will oppose it than have them not even mention it, because that means that young people are reading this and they're not even seeing that there's an issue. So whether they agree or disagree is not, I mean, that's between them and God. But I feel that it is our obligation and our responsibility as Christians to make sure that they at least know what the Bible has to say about it.
I'll never forget, one of the most charming moments of my life was, I was in a meeting, and there was a young woman there who'd moved from, it was the East or West Coast, and come to rural Tennessee. And she was slowly in the process of discovering, that the world was very different than she knew. And I forget what issue, I don't think it was Mark of the Beast, but it was something else, when it finally dawned on her that, the Christians were right. We had a board that was mostly Christians, and then some highly non-Christian people. And I looked at her and I laughed and I said, I said, Sally, sometimes us right-wing wackos are right. And the whole room burst out laughing. It was very funny.
It's great. I think it's great. Well, one of the things I love about you and about your program, Catherine, is no matter what the topic is, you're informing people. And I know you have listeners who are Christian, who are not Christian, but they know that they can trust that you believe what it is that you're saying, and that you believe where it is that you're coming from. And even if they don't share those views, they become informed about them, and they can come back later. They can do their own research. They can do their own prayer. They can pray for discernment. They can ask, whatever prayers they pray. They can say, hey, God, show me the truth. And really, I think all we can do is just be honest and share what we know. and let God sort it out. And he will. He does. He's really wonderful that way.
I have an article called The Data Beast, and in it I put up the interview of Aaron Rousseau talking about the Rockefeller explaining where this was going to go. And I think, you know, and Aaron was so credible and such a lovely person and such a caring person. And, you know, he's really lion-hearted. And I think that interview really helps people understand this is really true. This is really in the plan.
And the thing about Aaron, he told that to me before he died, and I'm probably the person in his film, America, Freedom to Fascism, who most talks about this aspect of things, the chip implantation, the control of people. And he was absolutely sincere and absolutely lion-hearted, I think is the right term to describe Aaron. What a powerhouse, what an incredible energy and vivaciousness and just zest for life and passion for the truth. And he did us all such a tremendous service with that film, America Freedom.
Oh.
If there's anybody out there listening who hasn't watched the movie, just watch it. Just, you have to. You must. I mean,
right.
just don't even pass go. Just get a copy and watch the film, because he did such an amazing service. And I think it was really that film that, I know it was that film that brought about the 2008 election with Ron Paul, that brought Ron Paul's rise to prominence. Because
right.
After you watch the movie, you say, what can we do? And there was Ron Paul in the movie. And so I think people said, okay, what do? We elect this man to office. I remember even at my church, somebody saying, I saw you in a movie. You know, I and I'm like, really, a movie? And they said, yeah, no, it was our mechanic, our car mechanic handed us this video and said we had to watch it. I think people underestimate the sheer number of folks across the country who saw that film and were impacted by that film.
Oh, I think it was unbelievably impactful.
If the Ron Paul campaign could have sent a copy of that movie to every household in America, they would have won the election five times over.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And it was also the movie where I discovered you. That's where I first learned about you and your work and got your book. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So
glad to hear that. Yeah. Yeah. And Aaron. I was in a Kinko's. I was making photocopies of something when my cell phone rang. And it was Aaron Rousseau, and he said, in his gruff, gruff voice, he said, somebody gave me your name and said I had to talk to you. And I was like, oh, sure. So next thing I knew, I'm flying out to Hollywood doing a movie.
I have to tell you one story. I went to see Aaron in the hospital right before he died. And the reason I'd gone, I had a friend who was also a dear friend of his, and I'd met him when we did the movie, but we had a prayer group, and we'd been praying for him and got a lot of very clear communications about him. And I went to see him, and he was still struggling, still hoping that he would make it through. And I said to him, you know, we've been praying, and we've been given a message about your situation. And I don't want to tell you unless you want us, you know, want me to tell you, but it's been so clear, and it's been coming so often that I wanted to see you. And he said, what's that? And I said, you know, if God does take you home, it's because he wants to guard your heart. You're so lion-hearted that he doesn't want your heart broken. And, you know, because he just kept fighting. And,
wow.
Yeah, it was a very powerful, clear message, and it was coming to multiple people in the group. It was very interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's encouraging to me, because I know that Aaron, we had a couple conversations.
He's coming back around.
I'm encouraged to hear that. I really am.
Yeah.
I was actually at his home with J. Edgar Griffin when we did that film. And
oh, wonderful. Oh, my God. I can't imagine the three of you in a room together.
We broke bread. We had a nice meal together, but it was quite the extraordinary experience. One of the high points.
Oh, you must have been levitating.
My life. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It was incredible to have that kind of energy all in one space. It was pretty amazing.
Well, before we shut down, I want to make sure you go through again your websites and how we go ahead and get the book. So just run us through how we find Spy Chips, how we find... If you haven't read Spy Chips, you really have to do it. And I don't care if you do...
10-year anniversary version, and I don't think I did too much, because everything we predicted in there has come to pass exactly, or is in progress exactly as we wrote it. So the book is called Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. Probably the best place to find that now is just Amazon. I think you can get it for like $11. It's pretty cheap. And my new book is called I Won't Take the Mark, A Bible Book and Contract for Children. And I Won't Take the Mark is available at virtuepress.com with the beautiful matching frames and the gift package and the gift wrap. Or you can find it at Amazon, which, again, I'm going to say that in low, dulcet tones there. Gosh, Amazon. Man, they're I have my own. We could do a whole other show on Amazon.
On Amazon.
Echo. Their new 7 microphone device that they want you to put in your living room that always listens to you and answers all your questions. Yuck. Anyway, I'm kind of boycotting them right now myself. But anyway, the book is available there. It's called I Won't Take the Mark. My website, KatherineAlbrecht.com, is my daily radio show. I'm on the air 2 hours every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6 Eastern, and you can find that at KMAshow.com. You can also, I have a 24-hour listen line, so if anybody has a phone and a pen and wants to write this down, you can hear the most recent show, and that's 605-562-7703. That's just a number you dial and you'll hear my show. I've got a couple of websites, actually, that we haven't talked too much about. We talked about StartMail, StartMail.com, the new private email. We talked about StartPage, the search engine you should be using instead of Google, so that everything you search for isn't being watched. The other websites I have are ChipMeNot.com, which is actually an anti-animal chipping website. We talk about the research that I did. They really put an end to human chipping in the U.S. We didn't talk too much.
Wonderful article. You should mention the name of that article. Oh, yes.
Yeah, we showed that implantable microchips cause cancer in between 1 and 10% of laboratory animals. And so I've got a whole article there at chipmenot.com, along with pictures of the horrible tumors and the animals and the awful things that they've suffered. If anybody in the listening audience has had an animal develop cancer around a tumor, please contact me, because we'd like to get your story and include it on the chipmenot.com website. Tragic though it may be, it can probably help somebody else. And then antichips.com is my website on opposing human chipping. And antichips.com actually has a piece of legislation called the Bodily Integrity Act, which is a one-page PDF written in plain English you can print out and hand to your lawmaker and ask them to please introduce this bill, because what it is it says, basically no one under the age of 18 should ever be implanted, and no one should ever be implanted against their will, and no one should ever be discriminated against for their refusal to receive an implant. So that's the Bodily Integrity Act. It's at antichips.com. It's also where you can see the candlelight vigil and protests in March that we did outside the Alzheimer's Community Care Center that got basically put an end to human chipping. So that's antichips.com, chipmenot.com, katherinealbrecht.com, startmail.com, startpage.com, and the new book is virtuepress.com. That's a lot.
You know, I feel like the last time I saw Tina Turner in concert, I turned to my friend and I said, what's my excuse? You get more done in a day, Katherine Albrecht, than anybody I know.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I've definitely been working hard for 15, 16 years. My next project, I think, is going to be a book about the breast cancer that almost took my life. So between 2011.
I know, you've beat that too.
Well, yeah, that was a
very good
big thing. So that's kind of my passion, is to help other women to stay safe and keep their lives if they're diagnosed with cancer. So that's next. I'll let you know when.
Okay. Well, we this comes with prayers for every success with this book and writing the next one. And we wish you all the best. Thank you again so much for being on the Salieri Report. You have a wonderful day. Okay.
Thank you, Catherine. God bless you, and God bless your listeners. Thanks so much for all you do.
Bye.